project, like a sandcastle, but tall enough that the top seemed to touch the clouds. Not that she'd ever been to the summit. Timothy's cave was much closer than that. The entrance was in a little canyon not far from the clearing where she'd first come upon him. Muskrat knew the way better than she did. She walked down the pale sand along the path carved by water that had long since dried. Wide, fresh Labrador paw prints marked her way. By the time Teresa left the last scraggly trees behind, the dog was already at the bend that led there, barking and wagging her tail. "I'm coming," Teresa said. "You're such a pain." Muskrat shrugged off the insult, turned and bounded ahead like a puppy. Teresa didn't see her again until she stepped under what looked like an overhanging shelf of sandstone and into the deeps of the cave. The natural stone gave way almost immediately to the soft glow of the cavern. Stalactites hung from the ceiling like bright icicles, and the walls were built with swirls and shapes in them, like a seashell and a Euclidean proof had joined together and become an architect. Teresa always had the feeling that the walls changed to greet her, but of course she was only there when she was there, so she couldn't be certain. A flock of tiny, glowing gnats flowed past her like a wave, like she was underwater. The air smelled thick and astringent, and a coolness radiated from the walls. Soft padding sounds came from ahead, not human sounds, and not muskrat either. The footsteps weren't even animal, not really. The repair drones were a little smaller than Muskrat, with dark, apologetic-looking eyes and multiply jointed legs. Totally alien, but they were the closest things to canine friends that Muskrat had, and the real dog ran around them, yipping excitedly and sniffing their rears, as if there were anything dog-like to smell back there. Teresa shook her head and moved forward. The repair drones made their query tone, trying to intuit whether Muskrat wanted something. The drones were surprisingly good at judging at least the rough intentions of humans. Real dogs still seemed to baffle them. The repair drones, the light gnats, the slow, creeping, worm-like stone diggers, were all in the weird space between life and not life, designed by an intelligence that evolutionary forces had taken in a direction very different from humanity. They weren't exotic to her at all. As far as Teresa was concerned, they'd always been there, just like that. "Hello," Teresa called. "Are you here?" The words echoed weirdly out of the deepness.
"Hey, Tiny. I wondered when you were coming back."
Timothy's part of the cave was like another phase change. Nature to alien to human. If not exactly the kind of human resident she was used to. A backpack reactor leaned against the wall, thick yellow power cords going to a wooden rack of neat, well-maintained machines. She recognized the yeast incubator and the emergency recycler from her tours of the early settlements. Other decks she didn't know. Altogether, it was enough that Timothy could live like a monk and a wise man in his mountain for more than a human lifetime. His bed was a cot against one wall with a blanket of woven polycarbonate that seemed never to show wear. He didn't have a pillow. The man himself sat next to a length of wood, a knife in his thick, calloused hand. A pile of thin, curled slivers rested between his feet where they fell as he carved. He was bald and pale, with a thick, bushy white beard, wide shoulders and arms with muscles like ropes. She'd come across him months ago during one of her first excursions. She'd been trying to get high enough on the mountain to see the state building, and there he'd been, eating his lunch and drinking from a scarred ceramic water purifier. He'd looked like nothing so much as an old cartoon of an enlightened guru meditating on a mountaintop. If there had been any threat in his smile, she might have been scared of him. But there wasn't, and she wasn't. And anyway, Muskrat had liked him immediately. "Sorry," she said, sitting on the edge of his cart. I've been busy. I have a bunch of new things I'm studying. What are you working on?
Timothy considered the half-carved wood. I was going for a marking gauge. I've got one already, but it's a little big for the fine work.
And you can't have too many tools, Teresa said. The phrase was something of a joke between them, and Timothy grinned.
Damn straight. So, what's up?
Teresa leaned forward. Timothy frowned and put down the wood and the knife. She didn't know where to start, so she started with her father's plan to train her up. He had a way of shifting his attention so that she felt like he was actually listening, not just preparing a reply in his head and waiting for her to stop talking. He focused on her the way he did on the wood he carved, or the food he cooked. He didn't judge her. He didn't quiz her. She never worried that he would be disappointed with what she said. It was the way she imagined her father would listen to her if he weren't her father. She wandered from topic to topic, telling Timothy about Connor and Muriel, the briefings and meetings her father was adding to her schedule, and all the day-to-day worries and thoughts that had built up without her even knowing, and ending with the unnerving conversation with Holden the dancing bear, and the weird way he'd said, "You should keep an eye on me," like it meant something more than it seemed. When she ran out of words, Timothy leaned back and scratched his beard. Muskrat had curled up on the floor between the two of them. The dog snored softly, and one leg twitched as she dreamed. Two repair drones queried each other, their voices clicking in descending musical tones. Just telling the story left her feeling better.
Yeah, he said after a while. Well, for what it's worth, you're not the first person that felt like the captain was a splinter they couldn't dig out. He has that effect on people. But if he says you ought to keep an eye on him, maybe you ought to keep an eye on him.
Teresa leaned back against the wall and pulled her knees up. I just wish I knew why he bothers me so much.
He don't treat you like you're special.
You don't treat me like I'm special. We're friends. He considered that.
Maybe it's because he thinks your dad's an asshole.
My dad's not an asshole. And Holden's a killer. He doesn't get to judge other people.
Your dad's kind of an asshole, Timothy said, his expression philosophical, his voice matter-of-fact. And he's killed a lot more people than Holden ever did.
That's different. That's war. He had to do it, or else no one would have been able to organize everyone. We'd just have stumbled into the next conflict unprepared. My dad's trying to save us. Timothy held up a finger like she'd made his point for him.
Now you're telling me why it's okay he's an asshole.
I don't... Teresa started, then stopped. Timothy's comment made her think of a philosophy lesson, and Illich talking about consequentialism. Intention is irrelevant. Only outcomes matter.
I don't tell anyone how to live, Timothy was saying. But if you're looking for moral perfection in your family, prepare for disappointment.
Teresa chuckled. If anyone else had said the same thing to her, she would have bristled, but it was Timothy. That made it okay. She was glad she'd made the time to come out to see him. Why did you call him Captain?
That's who he is, Captain Holden.
He's not your captain. A flash of surprise passed over Timothy, like it was a thought he'd never had.
I guess he ain't, Timothy said.
And then a moment later, and more slowly,
I guess he ain't.
Dad says he's afraid, Teresa said. Holden is, I mean, not Dad.
They both are,
Timothy said, picking his knife back up.
Guys like them always are. It's people like you and me that aren't scared.
You're never scared?
I haven't been scared since I was younger than you, Tiny. I had a rough start.
Me too. My mom died when I was a baby. I think my father doesn't like having women around me because it feels like replacing her. All my teachers have been men.
I never knew mine either, Timothy said.
But I put something together later that I could sort of pretend was family. It wasn't bad for someone that grew up on my street, while it lasted. I'll tell you what, though, as fucked up as my childhood was, it's got nothing on yours.
My life's perfect, Teresa said. I can have anything I want, any time I want it. Everyone treats me well. My father's making sure I have the training and education to govern billions of people on thousands of planets. No one has ever had the advantages and opportunities I have. She paused, surprised by the hint of bitterness that had crept into her voice.
Uh-huh, Timothy said. That's why you're always looking over your shoulder when you sneak out to see me, I guess.
That night, back in her room, she couldn't sleep. The small nighttime noises of the state building took on a weird power to distract and startle her. Even the gentle ticking of the walls as they radiated away the day's heat felt like someone knocking for her attention. She tried turning her pillow to press her cheek against the cool side and playing gentle, soothing music. It didn't help. Every time she closed her eyes and willed herself down toward dream, she found herself 5 minutes later with her eyes open, halfway through an imaginary debate with Timothy or Holden or Illich or Connor. It was past midnight when she gave up. Muskrat rose with her, following her from bedroom to office, and then, when Teresa sat on one of her workbench stools, curled up at her feet and fell immediately to snoring. Nothing bothered her dog, or at least not for long. Teresa pulled up an old movie about a family living in a haunted apartment on Luna, but her mind slid off the entertainment as quickly as it had off the pillow. She thought about going out and walking around the gardens, but that annoyed her too. When she realized what she actually wanted to do, she'd already known it for a while. Admitting it to herself felt like a surrender. "Security log access," she said. And her room system shifted from the haunted corridors of Luna to a business-like user interface. Even as honored and important as she was, there were logs that she didn't have access to. No one except maybe her father and Dr. Cortázar could have access to the recordings from the pens, for instance. That was normal. And it didn't matter for what she needed. No one was worried about preserving Holden's privacy. She could have watched him sleep if she'd wanted to. She set the system to generate a full track for Holden over the past week, then scrubbed through it. She knew that the state building had ubiquitous surveillance built into it, but it was interesting to see where exactly the micro-lenses were and how much they could capture while staying invisible themselves. As she scrubbed through Holden's passage in the buildings and the gardens, she thought about all the other things she could watch on the feeds. Connor and Muriel, for instance. On one of her screens, Holden sat on the grass, looking out at the same mountain where Timothy lived. The accelerated scrubbing made his casual gestures and adjustments seem spasmodic, like he was vibrating. Then Muskrat was there with him. Then she was. She didn't like looking at herself on camera. She didn't look the way she felt like she did. In her mind, her hair was smoother, and her posture was better. Without meaning to, she shifted on her stool to sit up straighter. Holden flopped to the grass and sat up with his back wet, and then she and Muskrat zipped out of the frame. She forgot her posture again and leaned forward. Holden fidgeted on the screen, then rose and sped off. Her scrub was at 20 times faster than base. In under an hour, she could take in the shape of his whole day. Holden at his dinner reading something on a handheld, Holden walking through the same common area her class had been in, pausing to talk to a guard, Holden in the gymnasium, exercising on the old-style machines that they used to use on ships, Holden sitting at a table on a veranda overlooking the city with Dr. Cortázar and a bottle of wine. She tapped the feed, dropping back to normal speed, and found an audio track.
"Also jellyfish," Cortázar said.
Teratopsis dornii is the classic example, but there are half a dozen more. An adult reverts to a polyp colony form under stress, like an elderly man turning into a fetus. That's not the model we're using, but it means the organism has no set maximum lifespan. He took a long sip from his wine glass. What model are you using? Holden asked. The original inspirations for the work were corpses that the repair drones got hold of. Not really immortality at all, but the new organisms had some improvements. That's where the breakthrough comes. That's what we should really be focusing on, sacrifice or no. Healthy subject with a well-recorded baseline instead of this, his voice rang with contempt, this field work. How to achieve a more robust homeostasis? Just because it's difficult to do doesn't make the principal science unsolvable. So, not unnatural at all, Holden said, tipping a little more wine from the bottle into the doctor's glass. Meaningless term, Cortázar said. Humans arose inside nature. We're natural. Everything we do is natural. The whole idea that we are different in category is either sentimental or religious. Irrelevant from a scientific perspective. So, if we get to a place that we can all live forever, that's not unnatural? Holden sounded genuinely curious. Cortázar leaned in toward the prisoner, gesturing with his left hand while he swirled his glass in his right. The only limits on us are what we can do. It's perfectly natural to seek personal benefit. It's perfectly natural to give advantages to your own offspring and withhold them from others. It's perfectly natural to kill your enemies. That's not even outlier behavior. That's all in the middle of the bell curve all the time. Teresa rested her head in her hands. She was pretty sure Cortázar was drunk. She'd never been herself, but she'd seen some adults at state functions get the same vague focus and sense of being a little off their own points. You're right, though, Cortázar said. You're exactly right. The foundation needs to be broad, that's true. Immortality is a high-stakes game, Holden said, like he was agreeing. Yes. Plumbing the depths of the protomolecule and all the artifacts it opens up is the work of 100 lifetimes. Making the researchers die and be replaced by other people with a less advanced understanding is clearly, clearly a bad idea. But that's policy. This is the way forward, so this is the way forward. Because Duarte made it policy, Holden said. Because we're primates who hold valuable things for our own bloodlines at the expense of everyone else, Cortázar said. Only one person can ever be immortal. That was what he said. But then he changed the rules. She can be, too, because he's found a justification for her. That she's really just an extension of him. I'm not mad about that. That's just the organism we are. I'm not mad. But it doesn't matter. That's good, Holden said. The important thing is that we get good data. One person, lots of people, all the same. But bad experimental design? That's what sin really is, Cortázar slurred. That's not me either. Nature eats babies all the time. Holden shifted, looking directly up into the surveillance camera as if he knew exactly where the hidden lens was, as if he knew she would be watching. You should keep an eye on me. Teresa felt a crawling sensation coming up her neck, and the feeling, even after he looked away, that he saw her as clearly as she saw him. She shut down the feed, closed the logs, and went back to bed. But she still didn't sleep. Chapter 15. Naomi. Getting what you want fucks you up. Naomi pushed the thought aside as she had a dozen times before. The first part of breaking down her shelter was the easiest. She'd spent years on the float, sometimes running cargo herself, sometimes fighting smugglers for the OPA and the transport union. She knew all the tricks. Disassembling her crash couch and system into parts was the work of 2 hours. Everything she had was modular, easy to take apart, easy to put into rotation as spare. Everything she'd had could dissolve back into the larger ship and not appear as anything more than a handful of off-by-one inventory miscounts. The empty container was a little harder, but only a little. According to the manifest, her container was supposed to be filled with the same payload of Earth-farmed bacteria and microbes and starter soil as 70 other containers in the ship. Shifting the contents of just a dozen or so to a slightly less dense configuration left plenty of overage to fill the space that had been hers. By the time the supplies reached their destination, she'd be elsewhere. And even if Laconia backtracked the discrepancies, there wouldn't be much to suggest anything more than run-of-the-mill theft. The real problem was time. Well, the first real problem. The Laconian ship was already on a braking burn. 18 hours to rendezvous didn't leave her much time for everything she had to do. Emma was a help. The woman had more years working transport than Naomi did, and she could drive a loading mech like it was part of her body. Even so, they were cutting it close. And every hour of the mech's hissing and clacking, the smell of industrial lubricant and the bone-deep ache of effort was another chance for the regular crew to notice that something strange was happening. Toward the end, Naomi sent Emma away to see whether there was any information about the larger picture. If other ships were being stopped. If this was a coincidence, or if the destroyer knew that Naomi was there. Until she knew, she had to assume there was hope. Another motto for her life these days. Naomi moved the last pellets into the steel and ceramic that had been her home for months, closed the doors, sealed them, and slapped a customs inspection sticker over the seam. She still had to stow the loader mech and replace the stickers on all the containers she'd cracked, but that wouldn't take more than another few minutes. She had almost half a shift before the inspection. A little over 4 hours to reinvent herself and blend in with the ship's crew. That was the second real problem. Getting what you want fucks you up. They'd been in a bar on Pallas Tycho not long after the two stations had become a single object. Clarissa had been in relatively good health then, strong enough she could go drinking anyway. Naomi didn't remember which bar they'd been in, except that it had gravity, so it had to have been in Tycho's old habitation ring. She did remember that Jim had been there. They'd been talking about how to address Alex's upcoming change in marital status. Whether he'd be bringing his new wife on the ship, or taking a leave of absence to be with her, or what. Every option had advantages. Everyone had drawbacks. Looking back, Naomi thought that on some level, all of them knew that the relationship was doomed. Clarissa had leaned back in her chair, a glass of whiskey in her hand. Her voice was thoughtful. "Getting what you want fucks you up," she'd said. "When I was in jail, there was nothing I wanted more than to be anywhere else. Then I got out, into an apocalyptic hellscape," Naomi said. "But even after that, when we got up to Luna and when we got on the Rossi, it was hard. I knew what I was when I was in prison. It took me years to figure out who I was outside." "We're talking about marriage, aren't we?" "Getting what you want fucks you up," Clarissa had said. Naomi put her hand on the transport container. She'd put herself in prison in order to be safe, and her safety had turned her captive. All she wanted was to wake up next to Jim again, to have something like a pleasant day-to-day life with him. And now that she couldn't have it, all she wanted was her hermitage back. Her hand terminal chimed. There was only one person it could be. "Where do we stand?" she asked. "I've got a plan," Emma said. "Meet me in Medbay 3. "I don't know where that is. Does the ship have a directory function? because I don't really think asking for directions is our best plan.
Shit. All right. Wait there. I'll be done in 10. I can take you there. Copy that, Naomi said, and dropped the connection. It gave her time to reseal the containers.
Emma, on the float beside her, held the hypodermic needle between her finger and thumb like she was playing darts. Her technique aside, though, the plan was about as solid as Naomi could hope for at short notice. She stretched her chin up, and Emma stabbed again, a quick pinch at her jawline at the right to match her already swelling left.
"How's that feel?" Emma asked.
"Itches," Naomi said. "Still up for the eyes?"
"Yeah."
Inserting her into the ship's roster wasn't possible. Even if they could backdate all the paperwork to the Bikaji Kama's last port, Emma didn't have the authorization she'd need. And messing with the system immediately before an inspection was an invitation to disaster. Fail to shut down one logging system, and the last-minute change was a flashing pointer to whatever you most wanted hidden. So making Naomi into a regular crewman wasn't possible, but making her not immediately match the biometrics for Naomi Nagata was in reach. All it took was a few well-placed needle sticks and some fluid that caused mild swelling. The only trick was changing the shape of her face in ways that made her look like someone else, and not just herself, only puffy. The med bay was old, but well put together. Nothing had the shine of the new. Everything was worn, but it was only worn, not neglected. Naomi had been around long enough to know the difference. She considered her new face in the hand terminal's camera. Emma's first move had been to shave her hair into an unflattering topiary that made her forehead seem wider and her eyes closer together. The swelling in her brow and jaw had thickened her features already. The system's match to her normal appearance was only 80%, enough that even if they identified her, it could be written off as a false positive. Unless they already knew she was there. "I'm putting you in with the crew working the heat sink," Emma said. "Chief has them swapping out coolant exchangers."
"Joy," Naomi said.
"The stink'll give you a reason to be wearing a mask," Emma said. "And it's a mixed shift crew. Any luck, everyone will think you're from the other one." Emma drove the needle into the flesh under Naomi's eye. It only hurt a little.
"How long do we have?"
Emma checked her terminal and spat out a low, grunting curse.
"We should go," she said, dropping the needle into Naomi's skin one last time. "They're already positioning for transfer."
"If they take me," Naomi said, "I will try to hold out until you can get away. But go quickly, and make sure Saba knows what happened." Emma didn't meet her eyes, but she nodded. This had always been a risk. It was what they'd signed up for. As Emma gave her a mask and led her down to the engineering decks, Naomi wondered how Bobby and Alex would find out about it if she was captured, and what Jim would hear. The temptation was still there. If she did it, if she jumped instead of waiting for the push, she could control the fall. The coolant lines on the Bikaji Kama were an old design, but in decent condition. She'd flushed lines like them back in her water hauler days, and the process wasn't that hard. Punishing and foul, but not hard. There were four others on the team, five people on a three-shift boat. It wasn't much of a disguise. The full process would run about 4 hours if nothing went wrong. She had to hope it was long enough for the Laconians to come, make their inspection, and move on. All she would have to do was stay quiet and small until the danger passed. She fell into the work, taking orders from the foreman, doing her part with as little fuss as she could manage. She'd almost forgotten there was anything to worry about more pressing than not getting too much coolant in the air filters when the interruption came.
"Make safe! Make safe! All you fucking bastards, hold the work and make safe, yeah?"
The others all closed down the lines. Naomi did too. There wasn't much choice. The man who pulled himself past the yellow work barrier was dressed in a chief engineer's uniform. Behind him, three soldiers in Laconian blues, one with a captain's bars. Naomi hooked her foot into a wall handhold. Her heart was going fast, and a hint of nausea plucked at her that had nothing to do with the stink of coolant. The chief engineer motioned for them to take off their masks. The others started to comply. If she hesitated now, it would only call attention where she didn't want it. Naomi pulled off her mask.
"Was that discussed with senior staff?"
the Laconian captain demanded, continuing whatever conversation they'd been having before they came into the room.
"No," the chief engineer said.
He was a younger man, but with a rough, scarred face that made him ageless.
"Why would it be?"
"Captain says it, we do it. That's how it is. That a problem?"
One of the other Laconians held a hand terminal up to the face of her team foreman. The terminal chimed. Naomi felt a sick kind of peace descend over her.
"It's an irregularity," the Laconian captain said. "The political officer will want a full report when you reach the transfer station."
"Political officer?"
the chief engineer asked. Despite herself, Naomi's ears pricked up. If this was related somehow to the mission in Seoul, if Laconia was making a broad crackdown, maybe they weren't here looking just for her. It was a thin hope, but it was something.
"New oversight regulations," the Laconian captain said as the hand terminal tracked over Naomi's face.
"Never heard of them."
"You're hearing about them right now," the captain said.
The soldier frowned.
"Sir, this one's not on the crew list."
"I am Naomi Nagata. I would like to accept the invitation of High Consul Duarte. Please let him know." It was all she had to say. It would even be a relief, knowing that she'd done all that she could first. The chief engineer looked at her and shrugged.
"Of course she's not. She's on the apprentice program."
The Laconian captain looked at her, uncertain. She kept the confusion off her face. No one on the ship but Emma was supposed to know she was there. Play along, she thought. Just play along.
"She's old to be an apprentice," the captain said.
"Had some trouble back home," she said, "trying to make something new." The lie was easy.
"She needs to be on the crew rolls," the Laconian captain said, turning away.
"Why?"
the chief engineer asked.
"She's not crew, she's an apprentice."
"Apprentices are part of the crew," the captain said, a note of exasperation in his voice.
"First I've heard of it,"
the chief engineer said.
"If I put her in, it starts counting her hours toward a benefits package like she was crew. That's not how it works."
"You can take that up with the political officer, too," the Laconian captain said.
The last of the work crew was scanned and cleared. As they left, the chief engineer looked back. His eyes met hers. There was a subterranean joy in them.
"As you all were. Shit's not going to maintain itself."
"Yes, chief," Naomi said, and put her mask back on. They fell back into the familiar rhythms of labor, but Naomi's mind was working on more than the lines. The others on the team didn't seem to have noticed anything odd in the conversation. One of them, a thick-faced man called Kip, treated her a little worse, but that was probably just because he thought she was lower status now. Nothing odd about that. When the new exchange was in, the old one sealed, and the diagnostics all in optimal range, Naomi wanted nothing more than a shower and a meal. She didn't have a cabin of her own. She didn't know where the gang showers were, and she wouldn't have a locker there. Even if she got to the right place, after she cleaned up, she'd have to put the same coolant stinking jumpsuit back on. That seemed worse than not cleaning up in the first place. She followed the others as they headed back to the crew decks, lagging behind. She wanted to go to her container. The urge to check her incoming feeds itched as badly as her jawline where the swelling was just starting to go down. But it was gone. Months of habit had just become irrelevant, and she pulled herself along the off-white halls, moving from handhold to handhold with the feeling of having woken from a long dream to find herself in some foreign station where she didn't belong. The mess hall had 6 people in it, but it was built for 30 or more. She pulled herself to a dispenser, but couldn't get food. It wanted an access code or ID match that she didn't have. She went to a corner by herself, bracing on a wall-mounted foothold, and waited without knowing what exactly she was waiting for. Her thoughts moved in the silence of other people's conversations. When, after an hour or so, Emma appeared, Naomi was almost surprised to see her. The woman pulled a double share of food and brought it over. "They've moved on," Emma said quietly. "Docked, ran down the whole fucking ship stem to stern, told the captain that he'd need to talk to someone at the transfer station, and gone." "Political officer," Naomi said. "I heard. We got word of one heading for the transfer station in Sol System, too. Earth."
"Well, looks like we have political officers now," Emma said sourly.
Naomi nodded with one fist. The crackdown was broad, then. A tightening of control over the whole transport union. More than that, it might be a sign that Duarte and his machinery were starting to suspect the transport union's role in smuggling the underground from system to system, or had other plans that wanted loyal and trusted eyes beyond the governors and their staffs. If they found the shell game, it could mean a serious retooling of their methods at best. At worst, the end of the underground. With Medina in control of the slow zone and their methods of transportation exposed, they were in real danger of becoming 1,300 fragmented, isolated movements, unable to support or help each other.
"No one checked you, though," Emma said.
"Oh, they checked her," a voice said behind them. The chief engineer floated over and took position beside them. "They caught her." Emma blanched. So apparently she hadn't been behind that.
"I appreciate you covering for me," Naomi said. "It might be better for you if we just kept it at that. I don't want to get you in trouble."
"Are you kidding?" the chief engineer said. "That was the best thing that's happened to me since I signed up for this haul. Seriously, it was my pleasure."
"I appreciate your enthusiasm," but he handed her a card.
"Override access to a private cabin and a commissary account," he said. "It's off the books, so even if there's an audit, it'll just come back as unused and overages."
Naomi looked at it, then at him. "Never look a gift horse in the mouth," they said. But it was bad advice.
"I'm guessing there's something you'll want in return, because I think we're going to need to be very, very clear what that is."
"No," the chief engineer said. "Nothing. You've already paid me out. I'm just glad I get the chance to hand some back."
"Excuse me for being rude," Naomi said, "but I've never really trusted the whole kindness of strangers bit."
"You're not a stranger," the chief engineer said. "You're the reason I'm an engineer. My dad was a kid on Ceres when the Free Navy stripped it. You and your crew? You put your hands out in peace in the middle of a civil war. You built the transport union. As far as I'm concerned, we should kick the captain out of his quarters and give them to you. You more than earned them."
Naomi reached for her hair, trying to pluck it down over her face, but Emma's haircut didn't leave enough for that.
"You know who I am, then?"
The chief engineer coughed out a laugh.
"Of course I do. Anyone in the belt's going to know Naomi fucking Nagata. It's just these Laconian fucks who can't see what they're looking at. And again, it's a real honor."
"Chuck," Emma said, and her tone made the word a warning.
"I won't say it again," the chief engineer, Chuck, said, lifting a hand. "But don't either one of you worry. I'll get you shuttle access as soon as we're close to port. You're safe with me."
Naomi nodded her thanks, and Chuck beamed. She saw now how young he was. His delight with himself made her heart ache a little. He'd gotten away with something, and his pride was bright enough to read by. She even had a sense of what she must look like through his eyes. A demigod. A figure from myth appearing in his life. A celebrity. God knew she'd seen enough people look at Jim with that expression. This must be what it had been like for him all those times. It was a feeling she could easily learn to hate.
Chapter 16.
Elvi. The ships were old transports that had been hauling people and supplies around Sol System's asteroid belt for a generation before the first gate opened. Elvi watched them being positioned near the surface of the Tacoma Ring Gate with the Falcon's highest power optical telescopes, and the images were still fuzzy. Both vessels were at most a few dozen meters top to bottom, and they were almost 1 billion kilometers away. If the Falcon's sensor arrays hadn't been orders of magnitude more sensitive than her eyes, they wouldn't have been anything close to visible. But she could make out the mechs and drones crawling over them, making the automated checks and last-minute verifications. Maneuvering thrusters bloomed and vanished as they shifted along the plating and drive cones, checking and double-checking that nothing would go wrong. There was deep irony in that. But if she thought about it too much, she just got angry. "Hey, sweetie," Fias said from the doorway. "Can I get you anything?" "Still no. Just like 3 minutes ago," she snapped. She grunted, regret jumping into her throat just behind the words. "Sorry. That was shitty." "No, I see where you're coming from," her husband and intellectual companion of decades said. "I'm hovering. Look." He let go of the handhold and floated free for a moment, grinning at his own physical pun. She laughed more at the grin than the joke. "I'm fine," she said. "Really. Perfectly fine." "Good. That's good. Because some people, when they almost die from being semi-drowned in half-alien goo while under a sustained high-G burn, get a little rash or zits. Near death can really do terrible things for acne." "I'm sorry I scared you," she said. "I didn't mean to, really. But I'm fine now." Fires pulled himself into the room, twisting ungracefully to hook his ankles around the wall footholds and absorb the momentum with his knees. He stood on the wall beside her, looking down at the images on her screen. "I'm sorry," he said, "that my deep existential panic at the prospect of your death hasn't faded as quickly as yours." "It's okay. I probably wouldn't be as calm about it if it had been you. By the time I found out about it, I already wasn't dead. Doesn't really have the same punch when you miss all the will she or won't she clinging to life thing." "Yeah," Fire said. "I didn't love that part. I mean, in fairness, I don't love this part either." She put up her hand, and he wrapped his fingers in hers. It was how they always were. Decades of habit shrouded what they meant in humor and wit. But she knew his distress was real, and that her resentment of it wasn't really about him as much as the raw idiocy playing out near the transit ring. She took a long, deep breath and let it out slowly between her teeth. "I feel stupid," she said. "I really thought we were a scientific mission." "Aren't we?" She pointed one thumb toward the monitor. "That's not science. Light shit on fire and see what happens isn't science. This is throwing dynamite into a pond to see if any fish float to the top."
"So, natural philosophy?"
"Military bullshit. Solving every problem by trying to blow it up."
"Yeah," Fire said. "Almost makes you wish you could quit, doesn't it?"
Elvi pushed back from the monitor. In free fall, it was only a gesture that she was disengaging. Fires' dark eyes didn't leave hers. "It wouldn't be the first thing that made me think that."
"But?"
"I know. If it wasn't us," she said, "it would be someone else. Someone who didn't know as much as we do. It's just..."
"You think whatever's on the other side will hit back?"
"Yes, maybe," she said. "I don't know. I don't like things that can only happen once. You can't make sense of something when there's no pattern. One data point is the same as none."
"Would you feel better if the big man committed to doing this again a few dozen times?"
A couple 1 billion kilometers away, the drive lit up for a moment, flickered, and went out. "I think he did." Elvi wasn't sure what the atmosphere on the science deck really was. She wanted to think that everyone else was just as uncomfortable with Sagali's plan, and, like her, staying as quiet about it. But the truth was that Jen and Travon looked excited. Their screens showed the inputs from a dozen probes and arrays scattered through the local void and three countdown timers. The first timer showed the time, down to minutes now, when the first ship would pass through the gate and, hopefully, into oblivion. Trailing that by only a few seconds, the timer for the second ship, the bomb ship, that would follow it. And then, with three full minutes more, the detonation clock. They were too far away to disarm the antimatter bomb. Making sure the experiment failed safe, if it failed, would be up to Medina Station. If the bomb ship somehow actually made the transit into the gate network, Medina would shut it down without detonation. The Falcon, almost a light hour away, was watching literal nothingness for signs that the thing beyond the gates, the thing inside them, had even noticed what they'd done. "You know what would be funny?" Faya said. "If this whole blowing things up plan broke the gate, and we were all trapped here on this ship for the rest of our lives with no way home." Sagali glowered and cleared his throat. "You're right," Faya said. "Too soon." The first counter fell to zero, turned from blue time to transit to red time since transit. In an hour, they would see it happen, hear the tech ships report. In the vast emptiness, all they had was the assumption that the plan had actually gone forward. "Everyone strap in," Sagali said. "If the enemy fires another of those void bullets at the system, we may lose consciousness for a time." Jen and Travon put on their restraints. Elvie already had hers on. Twice before, she'd lived through the consciousness-breaking backlash of pissing off whatever had murdered the protomolecule. Once on Illus, with an army of alien bug robots ready to cut her down, once sitting on a couch in a waiting room on Luna watching the news feeds as the Tempest prepared to annihilate Palace Station. She was almost used to it at this point. Or that was what she told herself. Still, she wasn't looking forward to doing it again. The second timer zeroed. The bomb ship was through the gate. Presumably, it had gone Dutchman, too. The second seemed to go slower as the last timer fell. On the screen, two ships waited outside the gate, preparing to begin the first transit. It was like looking into the past, waiting for something to happen that had already happened. The light bouncing off those ships and streaking toward her was almost an hour old, from her frame of reference, anyway. The last timer hit zero. Somewhere farther away than a mere normal light hour, something very violent happened in whatever non-space the gates passed through. Elvie held her breath.
"Are we seeing anything?"
Sagala asked, his voice tight and tense. "Nothing yet," Jen said. Elvie waited for the weird dilation of perception, the sense of being able to see atoms and waves, of experiencing herself and her environment in such detail that the border between them vanished, her body and the universe smearing together like a watercolor painting under a faucet. One breath, then another. It kept not happening.
"All right," Sagali said. "Protocol says we will hold position and remain in safety restraints until..."
"Holy shit," Travon said.
"Are you guys seeing this?"
On the screens, the space around them boiled. As Elvie watched, confirmation started rolling in from the outlying probes. One after the other, they all reported the same thing. An uptick in quantum particle annihilation. The underlying hum of the vacuum cranking up to a shriek.
"That," Travon said, his voice low and breathy, "is beautiful. Just look at it."
"Report," Sagali said.
"It's like what we saw in Sol System, sir," Jen said. "Virtual particle activity has increased massively. I'd have to say they noticed us."
"Check the timestamp," Sagali said.
Have we lost consciousness? Did we stay awake the whole time?
We did, Elvie said, even before she checked the data. I mean the second one. We didn't lose consciousness. We stayed awake.
Yeah, our entanglement experiment didn't break either, Jen said.
They all failed in Sol System. Ours looks fine. Whatever this is, it's different.
Sigala chuckled, and a broad smile grew on his lips.
Elvie thought it was the first time she'd seen the man showing anything like real pleasure.
Well now, he said, that is interesting.
God damn, Trevon said. Look at this. This is incredible.
The rates of virtual particle creation and annihilation were swamping the sensors. All the readings pegged at, shit if I know, but more than I can keep track of.
Elvie pressed her fingertips to her lips. She'd been braced for the weird dive into broken consciousness. That it hadn't come was somehow worse.
Continue monitoring, Sigale said. High Consul Duarte will be pleased with this.
Why? Elvie asked. Sigale looked at her as if she'd made a joke he didn't quite understand.
The behavior changed. It suggests the enemy can be negotiated with.
It doesn't show change at all.
You fired the magnetic field projector in Sol System, and whatever this is responded with the bullet on the Tempest. Then you came here and did something completely different, and it responded differently. There's literally no data we can take from that.
We know now that when we send a punishment ship through, the enemy feels it, Sigale said. All this? It isn't because a couple of ships vanished. Ships have been vanishing since we started using the gates. This tells us that the tool we've made can hurt them. That's very important. We won't know if it can teach them until we repeat the experiment.
And there it was. Repeat the experiment.
Jen, Trevon said. He hadn't heard anything Sigale said. All his attention was on his screens. Are you seeing this? There's precipitate.
Sigale's attention turned.
There's what? What are you seeing?
The virtual particles aren't all annihilating. It's generating some, looks like hydrogen ions. Basically just raw protons.
Does it pose a threat?
No, this is trivial. Even in normal interstellar space, you have an atom or two per cubic centimeter. This is still way below that. If this system hadn't already been weirdly empty, I wouldn't have noticed this at all. I mean, I guess if it goes on for a few decades, it could get to be a problem. Maybe.
Sigale looked over at Elvie. His plate-flat face was expressionless. It made him seem smug.
Still, Jen said, if it's the whole solar bubble, that is a shit ton of energy. Not rigorously speaking, of course, but just a lot.
Energy?
Faez asked. Energy. Matter, Jen said. Same thing. If they're creating actual matter, they're throwing a lot of energy at us to do it.
Is it evenly distributed?
Faez asked. Elvie heard something in his voice, a deep rasp that spoke of growing fear.
Oh, Jen said, and then a breath later. Oh, shit.
Kind of early to know that, Trevon said, clearly behind the curve. We've only got a couple dozen probes out there. Why?
So, I know I'm just the geology guy here, Faez said. But aren't we less than 2 light hours away from a neutron star? One that we were all really impressed at how something had designed it to be right at the edge of collapse, and now something's putting more energy and mass into the system? Because that sounds like it could be a problem.
Elvie's gut tightened.
Hold on, Jen said, her fingers dancing fast over her controls. The screen flickered as she generated energy curves against time and mass. A few seconds later, she made a little grunt like she'd been punched.
Well, shit.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Sigale said. Nothing has happened yet. The star looks stable.
The star was stable 2 hours ago, Jen said. But when a rapidly spinning neutron star collapses into a black hole, a gamma ray burst comes out of the poles. A few seconds of it releases as much energy as Sol would in its whole 10 billion years. They're very rare.
Trevon's face had gone ashy. Elvie felt a shifting sensation deep in her gut, pulling her between fear and awe.
"Commander Lively, are we about to experience one?"
Segale asked. But Jen was elbows deep in calculations before he said it. "It won't have gone critical," Jen said. "Not yet. Assuming the precipitate generation rate is uniform, which I don't actually know, but we should get out of here as quickly as we can."
"As quickly as we can without killing Elvie," Fias said. "We almost lost her once. We can't do a max burn." "All of us dying isn't better," Segale said.
Despite everything, Elvie felt a bleak tug of amusement at how fast the man could change his opinions in the face of evidence. The Admiral pursed his lips. His eyes focused on something internal, as he thought. Then,
"Commander Lively, please send out your analysis to the tech ship and the team on Medina."
He tapped his control board, and his voice echoed through the ship.
"All hands make ready. Expect an extended high G burn."
"We can't just shoot the ring gate, sir," Trevon said. "We've got about 1 billion kilometers to get to the ring and 1 million to slow down in on the other side. Less if we go at an angle, and we still need to miss Medina and the central station, so..."
"I'm aware of the issues," Segale said. "Please make ready. Major Okoye, I'm going to ask that you report to the medbay. My understanding is that we may be able to make this safer for you if we forgo sedation in the submersion couch. It will be unpleasant."
"That's okay," Faya said. "She's okay with that. We'll both go without."
"I will too."
He turned to her. "I'm sorry, sweetie. I just really need you not to die."
"I understand, Admiral," Elvie said. "I'll go now."
Segale nodded once, tightly. Elvie undid the restraints, pushed gently off, floating in the cool air. Faez had already launched himself down the corridor toward the couches. Elvie grabbed a handhold, stopping herself. She didn't know if the feeling in her chest was rage or fear or a bitter kind of amusement. Whatever it was, felt cold.
"Admiral?" "Yes, Major Okoye."
"I told you so," hovered in the air between them. She didn't have to say it. She could see that he'd heard. On the screen behind him, the first ship's drive came to life, moving the ship toward the ring gate. The illusion that it could still stop, that they could undo what had already happened, was as powerful as it was wrong. The bomb ship's drive cone flared a moment later as it moved to follow. In a smaller window in the same screen, the neutron star at the heart of the dead system glowed tiny and bright.
Chapter 17. Alex. Hiding a ship in space wasn't all that different from hiding on a school playground. Find something bigger than you and put it between you and the person looking. Even without something to hide behind, it wasn't impossible. Space was vast, and the things that floated through it were mostly cold and dark. If you could find a way not to radiate heat and light, it was possible to get lost in the mix. Alex ran a map of the Jovian system forward in time, then back again. The moon spun around the gas giant, then reversed and spun back to their starting places. Possible paths shot through the imaginary space like threads of copper, tracing the complex interactions of thrust and temperature and the ever-changing invisible clockwork of interacting gravity. And as he manipulated the variables, what paths became open if they could add another half a degree to the ship, what closed down if they shortened the burn time, the paths blinked in and out of existence. A plan slowly began to form. Finding an escape route to get the storm off Callisto before the Laconian battleship came in range meant plotting a course off the moon that only included engine burns, when the massive bulk of Jupiter was between them and the inner system, and then floating cold and dark when they were in the open. That narrowed the range down. But it was still a little more complicated than that.
Io, Europa, and Ganymede all had observation stations that might be in Laconian control.